Welcome to the Spectator Christmas Podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman. After ups and downs, wins and losses, celebrations and commiserations, 2016 is finally in its twilight hours. We've sat some of the Spectator's top staff and contributors down with a glass of mulled wine to steady their nerves as we ask the big questions. What happened in 2016? And what's coming in 2017? First, with an eye fixed firmly back in June, I'm joined by Tim Shipman, the political editor of the Sunday Times and author of All Out War, Nick Cohen and Spectator editor Fraser Nelson to discuss the first political earthquake of the year, Brexit. So Tim, you were writing your book over the summer in the weeks and months straight after the referendum. How surprised did you find the members of the Leave camp that they'd actually managed to win?
I think the politicians were probably more surprised than some of the backroom boys. I think Dominic Cummings, who was running Vote Leave, was always fairly confident that he could win if he could get the politicians to do what he wanted them to do. But Boris, as we all know, sort of went into it on a little bit of a wing and a prayer, not necessarily expecting to triumph. And Michael Gove, as we know, went to bed on referendum night and had it in his head that he might lose by up to 15 points. So I think everyone was a little bit surprised.
And you say in the book that Michael Gove was actually quite surprised by the fallout personally from his decision to back Leave. Surely a man of his insight and self-awareness shouldn't have been surprised that David Cameron, for instance, might have been a little bit peeved.
Well, I think Aaron Banks has a phrase about people he dislikes where he says there's nothing so stupid as clever people. And Michael Gove is one of the cleverest men in Westminster. But I think most people who know him quite well, who were not in the bubble with him that week, felt that it was pretty obvious that this would rebound badly on him. But all the people in the bunker helping him to make the decision said, go ahead and do it, it'll all be fine. And it wasn't.
Fraser.
So many things that jump out reading Tim's book, and which, by the way, I can recommend to all our listeners, if you haven't bought it, buy it or give it to somebody who cares about politics, because it will not be bettered as an account of Brexit. And I've been saving up until now, Tim, to ask you some of these questions.
I'll give you the 50 quid later
You know, reading it, there is so much. You could almost have written a book in any one of those chapters. Such was the great avalanche of drama. And the Michael Gove thing is a bit of a mystery. And you say midway through that there was a substantial figure in the media who told Gove that if he were to run as leader, he'd be backed. Now, to me, that says Murdoch.
You can imagine what you like, but there's a reason why I didn't name that individual.
Right. But then this was an event, though, which basically ruined Michael Gove. Oddly, it's still turned Britain upside down, but in a way, I think that things are looking pretty good right now. It's amazing reading this book. It is the story of a political establishment in battle and then disintegration. And if you look at where we are now, coming up to Christmas, I think it's quite extraordinary the amount of stability there is. We've slain populism. It's a problem in Europe, but it's not a problem here. We've got a prime minister with really quite high approval ratings, at their highest in the Midlands and in the North, which is unusual for a Tory. We've got a government which seems pretty stable. There's no real Heseltine figure or Gordon Brown figure trying to put the dagger in. The opposition is in disarray. And Britain seems to have gone through this incredible drama and this credible chaos in the summer, and ended up in a reasonable position with, again, the fastest growing economy in the G8. Lots of unanswered questions, sure, but every time we get a piece of economic data, it surprises to the upside. And now, you know, I think I'm ending this year feeling far more optimistic about next year than I expected to be feeling in the weeks after the vote. And I think the reason for that is because Theresa May took over so quickly and so decisively. If we had had, two-month-long leadership drama with her and Andrea Leadsom, she might even have lost, because she's not a particularly good personal campaigner. She doesn't like to open herself up a lot. And if we had Prime Minister Leadsom, we'd be in crisis. But I think, and I'm sure Nick Cohen will agree with me wholeheartedly, that things are in a pretty good position.
Nick, are you as upbeat as Fraser is about what 2017 will hold for us?
Well, no, not really. I think, first of all, that the notion that the sort of global wave of what people call populism doesn't affect Britain is interesting. It's generally true what Fraser says, but you can see the Tories sniffing the wind and the right wing sniffing the wind and playing with it.
I mean, democracy, though, isn't it?
The best definition I've read of populism, and one book I would recommend, is What is Populism by Jan Muller at Princeton. And the best definition is that you define the people as your supporters, And when you've won, and you can see this in Hungary, in Poland, in the Philippines now, I'm sure we'll see it in Trump's America, you use the fact that you are on the side of the people to trample down any restraints on you, free press, independence of judiciary. And you can just see the right in Britain playing with that, with the absolutely ludicrous attacks on the judges at the moment. And you see some ministers like Liz Truss sort of saying, maybe shall I support this guy, shall I not? I don't think that Britain is somehow as immune as we were in the 30s from authoritarian tides that are moving around the rest of the planet.
But surely part of Theresa May's success is that she has sort of come to embody the people. She has made such a play of trying to embody that decision. And if she's the worst populace we've got, then I think we're in reasonably good hands.
Well, you say the people, that's 52% of the people. She's made very little attempt to speak to the remainder of the country. I don't know. I mean, I'm simply saying that to sit there with an idea of British exceptionalism and to think we're all fine, whereas...
It does feel like we don't do revolution in this country. We tend to do evolution over the centuries. This looks a little bit more like the Glorious Revolution than the French Revolution right now.
If you look at... We did a leading article on this week's issue where we point out that The Spectator was set up as what was then regarded a populist movement. We were railing against these out-of-touch elites. We said there was a great popular tide that needed to be addressed, and our cause was to empower people disparaged as low-information voters. And we won. The cause was the 1832 Reform Act. And it was the first of an example of how British democracy crushes populism by responding to people's concern. And we, sure, that year was very tumultuous, way more than this year. But as a result, we did not go through the revolutions of 1848, but the rest of Europe did. And the reason that our democracy and our parliament is so kind of antiquated and medieval is because it's been working for centuries in a way that the parliaments of other countries have not worked. Now, I don't say we're immune to populism, but I would offer Francis Fukuyama's definition of populism. It's a name given by elites to ideas with which they disagree. If you manage to come up and respond to what's bothering people, in this case, the aftermath of the crash and the demographic change that's going along, if you can make out that you're responding to what they want, then populism dies down. In Britain, UKIP's almost disintegrating. It's very difficult to point to a continental-style nasty party menacing the government.
Tim Shipman, do you agree with that point about UKIP almost disintegrating? Labour MPs in the North are very nervous about the threat that the party poses in their constituencies.
I think the more significant thing that will happen in the next 3 or 4 years is to find out what Nigel Farage and Aaron Banks are actually going to do with the movement that they're trying to create. I think UKIP is almost a sort of sideshow. It can be relevant, but it will be relevant if Banks and Farage decide that it is, and if they decide something else needs to take its place or come along, and they're going to campaign for individual MPs who they agree with on Brexit, be they UKIP candidates or Tories. I think Banks has got this idea of a sort of turfing out MPs that he doesn't like very much, he thinks are corrupt or useless. He appears only to have identified 200 of them, which anyone who's talked to Banks probably thinks is an underestimate of his true views of the House of Commons. But I think what those guys decide to do next is the more interesting and significant question, and we don't sort of wholly know how that's going to pan out yet. If they do throw their weight back behind UKIP, then yes, it can be a force, but it may well be something a little bit different, and you might find with what they're doing and what Tony Blair appears to be doing from the centre, momentum is apparently dividing already between Trots and Stalinists even as we speak, so who knows what will be happening from the left. But I think the most interesting development will be, you know, what do these sort of potentially three different movements do as opposed to the political parties?
And this is a really interesting question about the future, isn't it, Nick, that actually we could be seeing out of this referendum, in the same way as we did the previous referendum, the birth of a new party, potentially actually in this case several new parties. Do you think that's plausible?
New parties traditionally have a hell of a job establishing themselves in Britain. So, but your broader point that politics has changed, which you can see a bit at the Richmond by-election, and you may even see it at other by-elections, that people's attitude towards Europe now drives the way they vote. I think that's a very good one. And I would say with to what Tim said, that whether it's Aaron Banks's movement or whether it's UKIP, the big fact, and this goes to what Fraser was saying about the apparent dominance of the actual dominance of the Conservative Party, is that Labour is just a gift for them under Corbyn. It's just an absolute gift to everyone else, really, to every other party. It's like a free buffet. It's anyone can just go and pick from it. But if you're on the right wing, you know, you've got a Labour leader who appears to be against Britain being in the single market for economic benefits, but in favour of open borders, which is sort of the wrong way round. I would have thought if you're trying to get elected...
If you're trying to get elected.
So if there is going to be a successful party to the right of the Tories, getting working class votes, a lot of working class votes, as has happened on in France in particular, then this is an ideal situation for them.
One of my favourite,
the way it is.
One of my favourite stats that comes out of this whole thing is that if you look at the 25 most Remain seats in the country, 20 of those are Labour in London, the university towns, and if you look at the 25 most Brexity seats, 20 of them are also Labour. And, you know, Jeremy Corbyn is quite unsuited to going and winning the latter section, and the party is, you know, divided between these two utter polar opposites.
Speaking of unsuitable leaders, Fraser, it's not just Jeremy Corbyn who has difficulties in terms of leading a movement. You have Tony Blair talking about a movement in the centre, but he is arguably too politically tainted to do that himself. Tim Farron, the leader of the existing centrist party, the Lib Dems, is not really a particularly telegenic prospect either. Who is the future new leader of a centrist movement? Or even if Nigel Farage is also tainted, as the Leave campaign saw him, someone from the right?
Well, this is the great question to which there is no real answer right now. I mean, the reason Jeremy Corbyn is still there is because his party haven't come up with a decent practical alternative. In a way, I wish there was, because I do think that Tories get very lazy in government if they're not scared of the opposition. And right now, Labour is a danger only to itself. And they've gone through this exercise twice now, trying to find out who is the voice of the centre, the voice of the... It's not so much the Blairite legacy, but the voice of a Labour movement, which is far more in tune with Labour voters than Jeremy Corbyn is. And they haven't found an answer. Now, there is, you know, this great theory, cometh the hour, cometh the man. If the problem is big enough, then the right person will come along. But that doesn't always work. I mean, just look at America right now, for example. You couldn't get anyone to take on Donald Trump, and look at the results. So, and also with Liberal Democrats, I don't read as much significance as Nick does into the Richmond by-election, because nobody really contested that seat other than the Lib Dems. And I still can't see much of a long-term future for them, which is odd, because you'd think Labour going so far off to the left would create a great attractive centre-ground that they're already camped on, and people might bring them in. And I would love that. Look, the thing is, we didn't predict any of the major things that shaped 2016. I would like to think the big thing I'm not predicting for 2017 is somebody coming along to salvage the centre-left, and I really hope somebody does.
And finally, in terms of the government's approach to Brexit, Tim, do you think Theresa May and her ministers are any closer to having any idea of what Brexit will actually look like? This week we've had the red, white and blue Brexit, which makes even less sense than Brexit means Brexit. It's starting to sound like an Edward Lear poem, but behind the scenes, do people really know what's going on?
Yes and no. I think on the one hand, they know the big, broad parameters fairly simply, and actually any sentient human being who pays attention knows that we're not going to be in the single market, and that at the very least there is a hearty debate going on about whether we're members of the customs union or whether we do it sector by sector. I think if you read the runes, you can piece together quite a lot. And now that the government have had their hand forced a little bit, I think what they'll publish is a pretty fair summary in the new year of what most intelligent people know already. In terms of what their bottom lines are, no, I don't think they've worked that out yet. And I think most of the cabinet committee work that will actually make the decisions is yet to take place. Most of it so far has been a sounding exercise. Most people tell me that, you know, they'll start looking at that in January and February, and then some decisions will actually be made. The interesting thing will be how many of them they actually tell us about, because you can be fairly sure they'll leak.
Nick, do you think that the government's approach so far has been quite unimpressive, or do you think it's fair enough given the shock that Brexit was?
I think not just the government, but journalistic political culture in general has underestimated. Let's talk about what are we asking for. We haven't thought about what the EU will give, and the EU has to defend itself. You know, it cannot be seen to say to everyone else in the EU, you leave and you get a great deal. And sometimes better terms than you would have inside the EU, because you wouldn't have the burdens. And we have a very insular political culture. We don't speak foreign languages. We cover America exhaustively. We don't cover Europe. And I think that ignorance may come back to haunt us.
There's a very good piece by Jinan Ganesh in the FT along those lines this week, actually, which talks about, you know, the enemy has a vote here, and we're obsessing in this country about what Theresa May's position is. The more important decision is what is the position of the 27, and, you know, all indications are is that they will stick together, and it'd be very difficult for us to peel them off one by one.
I think the most likely outcome right now is no deal, actually. I mean, we saw with David Cameron's renegotiation how difficult it is to get 26, 27 veto-wielding countries to agree on anything, far less something as sensitive about Britain leaving the EU. I mean, as Nick says, as an institution, they need to see that Britain is going to be worse off. They need to show that it's being punished, because a lot of the things keeping people in the EU is fear of what would happen if you leave. So right now, if I were to bet, I would say we're going to end up in the World Trade Organization and what you might call cleanest or hardest Brexit, depending on your point of view. But basically, I can't see Theresa May making much progress, and I'll be pleasantly surprised if I'm wrong.
That was Tim Shipman, Nick Cohen and Fraser Nelson. Next, we're jumping ahead 5 months, not to mention crossing the Atlantic, for our second 2016 retrospective. If Brexit was the appetizer, then the main course was deep-fried Trump. I'm joined to discuss the landmark election by The Spectator's deputy editor Freddie Gray and Douglas Murray. So, Freddie, this time a year ago, very few people expected that Donald Trump would be president-elect of the United States. Are we actually remembering that wrong? Were people already starting to see the signs of the victory that took a lot of the world by surprise?
I think people were starting to see the signs by January. I think what really happened was there was the summer of Trump beforehand, where in August, because it's the slow news month, as everyone knows, he generated a lot of publicity with various statements, you know, calling Mexicans rapists and so on, in his first speech when he declared his candidacy. And I think everybody thought, as soon as the summer's over, we'll return to normality and, you know, Jeb Bush or someone like that, or Marco Rubio, will emerge as the obvious candidate for the Republican Party. But that just didn't happen, and that was the most amazing thing.
And was that a failure of the Republican Party, Douglas, or do you think that was actually just Trump's genius and the way in which he didn't seem like a conventional politician in a way that the other Republicans did?
It was impossible to foresee any of it, I think. The assumption that most of us had made was that there would at some point be a gaffe so great that it would be unrecoverable. But as time went on throughout his run, it became harder and harder to see just what that could be. I remember sitting somewhere in the US the year before when the insult of John McCain occurred, and it was on the front of the New York Post. I remember sitting with some friends going, well, that's the end of Trump. And gradually over time, you learnt not to do that with every single thing that was outrageous he was meant to have said. But it just became, it still, you know, one sort of had that thought that at some point, surely. And then, of course, just before the election, when the sort of the surprise of the tape of him talking about women came out, some people still thought, well, that one might or must have done it. And then that didn't either. So
it's an interesting point, actually, just about the expectation that there would be a gaffe or a moment that would finish off Trump. And I have to confess that when I heard about the tape, about Trump boasting about sexually assaulting women, I thought, oh, this must be it. Surely this is the point at which the electorate turn away from him. Is this a lesson, amongst all the many other lessons for politicians more generally, mostly that they're wrong and they don't understand their voters anymore, that actually they don't need to worry about slipping up in the way that they've become obsessed with over the past few decades, not just in terms of spin, but in terms of really couching their language really carefully and becoming very boring?
Well, I think it's worse or better from a news point of view than that, in that slipping up is actually, it was valuable to Trump because it just meant that he was always in the news, and Clinton couldn't actually get a position, a media position. And in some way that helped her, because in fact, the more people saw of Hillary Clinton, the more they were put off. But Trump was able to just completely blow up the media every week. And he's carrying on doing that. I mean, I think eventually we're going to get to an exhaustion point with his Twitter account, and people are going to say, OK, we know what's happening here. He's going to do a massive stream of tweets, and it'll all go. And people finally get tired of sort of Trump's madness.
And not just on social media. Do you think that Trump is having to tone down the way he approaches, well, other politicians? We've seen some of the readouts of phone calls that he's had since being elected, Douglas. My particular favourite was the call to Pakistan, in which he just talked about everyone being wonderful and getting on really well, which I thought was an interesting reading of the situation.
Yes, my favourite was the discussion with Viktor Orban when Orban described himself as being something of a black sheep in Washington, and Trump said, so am I. But just to quickly on this issue, I mean, it's a very interesting one, because certainly in Britain, but in America increasingly in recent years, yes, any public appearance by a politician has had very little benefit potential, but a huge risk. You can see it in the eyes of British politicians when they appear on television. You know, they might say something wrong about what we think about rape now, or women, or gays, or something else. And you can see it in their eyes that the aim is to just get through without that.
The sort of Danny Alexander technique.
Absolutely. Bore the public into submission, and or at least to, you know, turning off. And I think that the important thing to remember about Trump, though, is it isn't quite what... I mean, both of you have said something I would pick up on here. It isn't quite what it has been reported as. So, for instance, Freddie said that Mexicans are rapists. And, of course, the actual comment...
No, of course, yeah.
The actual comment was clearly that some of the Mexicans are rapists, and then, of course, and I'm sure some of them are very nice people. The whole tone and context of it, of course... You know, we all know, if we listen to it, we know he's joking about something. He's also kind of nasty, but it's within a parameter which, after he said it, it was immediately put outside of.
Yes.
And every single thing he did ended up encountering that.
And this is a really interesting element of this election as well, isn't it? That obviously in every election there are smears and misquotes from the other side. But one of the words that we hadn't really heard at the start of this year was fake news, which has now become a big phenomenon.
Yes.
Freddie.
Well, I think Trump very much thrives in this sort of supposedly fake news environment. What he does a lot, as Douglas says, is a sort of bait and switch. I mean, I think the interesting thing about Trump is actually, if you really analyse him, he's fundamentally quite politically correct, because he will always say something incorrect with a sort of correct hedge. And actually what you'll see is that, you know, people will say, oh, that's outrageous. And then they'll read the quote and they'll think, oh, well, he did say some, or, you know, oh, he wasn't just talking about the Mexican judge's parents being evil because they were Hispanic. And so it's the relief from the initial shock that makes people warm to him.
But how does I'm not quite sure what word to use, normal, sensible, run-of-the-mill politician respond to Trump in terms of the way they behave as a politician? You can't be another
Trump.
Pack up
their bags and go home.
Well, there is that, but if you want to beat Trump, if you want to be the next president of the United States to stop Trump having two terms, if that's possible, what do you do? You can't out-Trump Trump, but you can't be boring. You can't be Hillary Clinton.
Well, you could be, of course, couldn't you, next time round? I mean, you could be boring. You could probably... better if you weren't Hillary Clinton. But I would have thought the obvious thing is to watch what he actually does. We've spent such a long time talking about what Trump says and what it might hint about him or tell us about him. And now we're in a totally different period where we're going to have to see what he does. Do the American people indeed become tired of winning? Do they become bored of it? Or do they discover that, having been overpromised by another candidate, that it doesn't work out like that? And if so, then his opponents will not be talking about which words he used. They will not be talking about whether or not he said you can sexually assault a woman, or whether he said you can grab them with their consent because they like you, you're a celebrity. They'll be talking about the impact of his policies on Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan. And they'll be seeing whether or not he has improved relations with Moscow in a decent way or not, or an embarrassing way for Washington. So that's what we'll end up being able to discuss with Trump. And I, for one, think it'll be a huge relief. It'll be about facts.
And what sort of facts are you expecting, Douglas? Are you expecting America to become isolationist to develop stronger alliances with Russia? What are you...
I don't want
you to make too many predictions,
no,
but...
I won't make any predictions, but I think people will be surprised, and I think that anyone who thinks that the isolationism, for instance, is obvious, has not paid attention either to his appointments or indeed to previous presidents. Also, all of us who remember anyone, you know, of any American president, remembers the fact that they run as one thing, and then when they're in office, something else happens. I remember George W. Bush running as actually rather more isolationist than Donald Trump in many ways. W. Bush certainly didn't talk about, you know, which things he'd really like to intervene in and really sort out, you know. So he ran as a vaguely isolationist candidate, but within a year of coming into office was quite the opposite. It was state building, nation building, or trying to all over the place. So, and it'll be the same with Trump.
Do you agree with that, Freddie, that the appointments and some of the statements that Trump has made since being elected contradict some of his campaign strategy?
Well, I think Douglas is right to say that it's refreshing that there could be a real focus on what Trump actually does eventually, because what he says will become tiresome. I suppose that the real facts about Trump might start to become more clear, and that's the mystery, is that is he going to become a sort of kleptocrat? Is he going to try and keep his businesses going and use government to make his businesses more profitable? I mean, that will be what the lefty press obsesses over, and perhaps they will find legitimate stuff. And will people care? That's another big question.
He'd be a great fool if he did allow any of that to invade onto it. He must know that's his big vulnerability in the short term.
Yes, but I think the evidence suggests he's very incapable of thinking about anything other than business. Business is the person who he is, and so he's not really a politician in any way. So it will be interesting to see that. I'm not saying that he will become a kleptocrat. I think that will be the big focus of obsession of the left, and they may well find plenty of evidence.
And in terms of two of the totemic domestic policies that were discussed during the election, Obamacare and the wall, what have we heard since about those two issues?
Definite turning down.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yes, it's a turning down on both of them, obviously. I mean, he's going to have to become used to saying, you know, that's something I said on the campaign.
Can he get away with that? Or does he have the same punishments that other politicians get for this sort of thing?
In the long term, I mean, on both those things, unless he can get the immigration thing at least better than it currently is, and unless he can come up with some kind of viable alternative to Obamacare, then they will punish him. I mean, you know, he spent a lot of time being a destroyer, and now he's got to be a builder, whether of a wall or anything else, we don't know. But he's got to build up policies, and then we'll judge him on that. But it is quite, as I say, the real thing is that if at the end of 4 years, the Trump supporters have the same sense of letdown that Obama supporters did after it turned out he didn't, you know, stop the oceans rising and all that, then we will just see one of the most disappointed democratic nations in the world.
Freddie, what would smart Democrats do now, over the next year, next 4 years?
I think they'd recognise the fact that they lost on class grounds. They were so obsessed with race and gender for a long time, and they ignored the fact that their core vote, the working class or lower middle class in states in the Rust Belt and so on, had completely deserted them. Not just the dribs and drabs we saw in Reagan and Bush, but completely deserted them, and they are no longer the party of the poor in America. And now you have this extraordinary situation of Trump being the representative of the poor in America. So the Democrats, I think, will learn that, you know, Bernie Sanders probably would have been a better candidate than Hillary Clinton. Would he have won? I don't know. I tend to think yes, but lots of people who know much more about this than me say no. So I think they will, if they're smart, they'll recognise that they've got to stop this identity politics and focus on being a party that betters the economic interests of the poor.
And Douglas, if Republicans are as dismayed by Trump in office as they claimed they would be during the campaign, what can they do to rebuild their party? I mean, at the start of this year, we were talking very much about the collapse of the Republican Party. And what do they also do to deal with another group that we haven't really heard much about until the election, which is the alt-right? Just tell us a bit about that.
Well, the obvious thing would be, on the first thing, I don't think the Republican Party has that much rebuilding to do. I mean, it's done terribly well. As you say, I mean, it's one of the oddities of politics, certainly the last year, that we talk about the collapse of one thing and the other thing collapses instead. And I wouldn't be confident to say, you know, how they sort the party out. They've obviously got to keep some distance between the president-elect at the moment and the party, and that's going to be a natural divide. As for the so-called alt-right, I wouldn't be surprised if this wasn't the sort of Philip Blond, as it were, of this period.
What I thought.
I don't wish to insult Philip Blond, but I mean, in the, you know, at the beginning of Cameronism, there was that sort of thing that, oh, this is the thing that's most connected with it. And these things are very amorphous, influential ideas, intellectual ideas, input from various. They all sort of fall away after a bit because just the business of governing happens. No, we're not going to be
saying Milo's just a fad.
No, I'm. Look, in 2 years' time, I'd be very surprised if we were talking about the alt-right. Nobody can quite put their finger on what the alt-right is. It's a very interesting sort of morphosis. It's obviously a movement. It's obviously a sort of response. It's obviously a thing. But people can't find out very much about it because it isn't much. It's not. We can't put our finger on what it is intellectually because it isn't an intellectual movement with himself.
Whereas Philip Blond, you know, was an intellectual movement in a way.
I crucially do not want to say that I'm sort of insulting Philip Blond on this. But it's just that these ideas that people are bound to intellectual movements is sometimes a mistake. But the obvious thing would be, if I may say so, with the so-called alt-right, is to actually identify, the press in particular have a duty to find out honestly what it is, honestly what the people involved with it are saying, not say that they're all Nazis, unless they are all Nazis, and to actually, you know, do investigative journalism on it. And then the job for Trump would be to see if he can do with them what Republicans in the past did, for instance, with the John Birch Society. Are they able to make very clear blue water? Are they able to make it so clear these are not their people that actually the alt-right or, you know, whatever, are useful to Trump? Well, you know, you say I'm this far out there, wacky, crazy guy. You should see who's beyond me. But as I say, I for one would really like it if people in the coming months just looked at the origins and the truth about political movements instead of just continually using them as a way to win. You know, those guys are Nazis, anti-women, pro-rape, racist, so and so. Hear me roar, I'm great. And that's sort of been the limit of it so far.
That was Freddie Gray and Douglas Murray. And if you enjoyed Freddie's musings on the US, his Americano podcast series will be continuing into the new year. And finally, after such a blockbuster year, it might be difficult to get excited about the sequel. But like it or not, 2017 is coming. So what do we have to look forward to? And what do we have to fear? To answer those impossibly large questions, I'm joined by The Spectator's political editor James Forsyth and Peter Oborne of the Daily Mail. So let's start, before we start making predictions about 2017, just having a little look at the things that we got wrong about 2016. James, what has surprised you the most? What prediction did you make that you regret the most about this year in politics?
Well, on Brexit, I thought we would end up leaving, but only after two referendums. I thought that the Leave side would get close. I thought the result would be kind of the opposite way around than it was at the start of the year. And I thought pressure would then build for another referendum as it became clear that the European Union wasn't going to solve many of the kind of fundamental problems that worried British voters, and that you'd then have two referendums and out. But the thing that took me by far more surprise was Donald Trump's victory in America. I think this time last year, I thought that he would struggle to get through the Republican primary. I thought that when he lost in Iowa, as he did, that that would kind of take some of the kind of air out of his balloon. And I also thought that a kind of thrice-married New Yorker who had very socially liberal views until a few years ago could never win a Republican nomination. You know, it is worth remembering that when Rudy Giuliani was at the height of his kind of America's mayor post-9/11 standing, it was his own private life, which is not that similar to Donald Trump's, was what stopped him from getting the Republican nomination. It is very interesting that Trump managed to get past all of that.
Peter, how about you? What surprised you the most this year?
The thing which surprised me most of all was Leicester City winning the premiership, and I was really pleased about that. Then I was completely dumbfounded by everything which happened thereafter. And I think it's been the most important year since 1979. 2016 has been a momentous year in history. It's seen the end of the liberal dominance, you know, the challenge to neoliberalism, the challenge to sort of liberal ideas, and some form of popular revolt against an economic and social system which had clearly started to let down the majority of populations while making a small minority incredibly rich and empowered.
So that sounds as though you think what's happened this year has largely been a good thing.
I'm not saying it's been a good thing, because it's clearly also unleashing divisive forces, dangerous forces. I don't like the look of the people around Trump. And I can see, and you can see looking at 2017, you can see the most awful things happening in Europe with a return to something quite close to fascism. So not to fascism, I think you would be very careful about the way you use that phrase or word, but clearly something dark can happen in Europe.
So James, just looking ahead now to 2017, do you expect it to be as dramatic as 2016? And do you expect it to be a positive year, a year in which things are sorted out a little bit more after the chaos of this year?
Well, I think the most interesting question about 2017 is something that we don't even know whether it will happen or not, whether Italy has elections or not. After Matteo Renzi's resignation, he wants early elections, some of the opposition parties want early elections, but there's a slight problem. No one's quite sure under which electoral law they would be conducted, and the president doesn't want them. But if you had elections in Italy, there is a serious chance that you could see the election of the first anti-euro government in the Eurozone. And that would be a far bigger shock to the European project than even Brexit was. And that really could change things. I also think, look out for the elections in Holland. I don't mean Geert Wilders is going to become Prime Minister, because even if he tops the poll, I think all the other parties wouldn't support him. But the fact that someone, the fact that in one of the founding member states of the European Union, someone could top the poll who is as opposed in its entirety to the European project as Wilders is interesting. But then on Peter's point, I think what is alarming is that Geert Wilders' views on Islam really are out there. You know, this is a man who wants a ban on the Quran. And I think one thing that everyone should remember is there was a lot of talk after Donald Trump won that, you know, Angela Merkel was a person who was going to stand up for liberal democracy. Well, she just told her party congress that she wants a ban on the burqa, a legal ban on the burqa in public places. Now, that strikes me as kind of almost kind of worse than anything that Trump has said. It's a kind of thoroughly illiberal act.
So, Peter, do you think that 2017 will be a year in which we see divisions which have been quite clear this year become further entrenched?
Well, I think it's infectious, this thing. Trump is infectious. And I'm very interested in what James says about Italy. Of course, Le Pen is just as significant. And Wilders is absolutely horrifying. We haven't even got onto the issue of the euro, which is fundamentally broken and totally destructive of economic life in the European Eurozone, in the continent. And this is a very melancholy and terrifying background. My view is that the best thing would be for the Eurozone to break up quite quickly so as to enable some form of economic recovery to take place on the continent. The other huge question is the European Central Bank. I mean, it's just creating money, and who does this money belong to? You know, it's not like the Bank of England, which we know it's linked to the British state. The ECB is a freewheeling hedge fund, and at some point somebody calls time on it. There's going to be an argument about who owns which debt. And that debt will at that point be worthless. And so I think we are now entering the most perilous period in history for 80 years, and I think we are entering very momentous times.
James, you were nodding along as Peter was talking about the future of the Eurozone. Do you agree with his analysis about the need for it to break up?
Well, I think, just look at what the IMF say. The IMF say that Italy will not return to its pre-financial crisis peak in the economy until 2026. That is two lost decades. I think one of the things people say, oh, the Italian referendum was different from Brexit and Trump because young voters voted for it. Young voters voted against Renzi and the reforms. The reason they did that is look at the level of youth unemployment in Italy. It is shocking. GDP per capita in the south of Italy is now lower than in Poland. You know, that is the euro's doing, and I really do not see much economic hope for Italy until it gets out of this straitjacket of a currency with interest rates set to benefit Germany. You know, I mean, if you look at this, what is going on is you clearly need fiscal transfers. German industry is benefiting from an artificially devalued currency, and southern Europe is massively suffering from an overvalued currency.
And moving further away from Europe, Peter, let's talk a little bit about Syria and whether we'll see any change at all in the situation in 2017, or at least any positive change.
Well, the situation's changing very fast indeed. And we're reaching a stage when we can look to the end of the Syrian conflict, because it's been won by Assad, Russia, Iran and Hezbollah. And the next issue is, it looks like they'll have taken Aleppo by the end of this year, back from the al-Qaeda rebels. And then you move on to Idlib, and then they would be driving al-Qaeda back across the border into Turkey. And so I think that's quite hopeful. I've taken the view from the start that the British policy of just keeping the war going as much as we can without actually solving it has been disastrous in a humanitarian basis, let alone all the other effects. That does bring us on then to Turkey, because the al-Qaeda and ISIS people who have been backed from by the West and Turkey will then start to flow back north. They were very destabilizing for Turkey. At what point does Erdogan then start to blackmail the West again and send millions more refugees into Europe? I think that the ending of the Syrian civil war, which I think is quite likely next year, is a good thing. I hope we don't try and stop it by empowering our regional or allowing our regional allies to get back in again and start to pumping it up, because it will just bring, just just lengthen the horror. If peace can start to come to Syria, then you will get people coming back. You can start to rebuild communities. And, of course, there's a lot of reconciliation going on anyway underneath the, not at headline level, but at local level. Lots of local reconciliations.
James, we've obviously been watching the United States very closely to see what the shift in foreign policy, particularly towards Syria, will be as a result of Donald Trump's election. But what signs are you picking up in Westminster about any shift from ministers in terms of their approach? There's been a fair amount of pressure on them to change their approach, but very little in terms of signals, as far as I can see.
I think everyone in Westminster is very aware that Trump will seek a grand alliance with Putin, and we are looking at a situation where the Russians and the Americans will basically unite, accepting Assad's continued presence to try and defeat Islamic State. I think Britain knows that whatever its views on the wisdom of that or not, it can't change that policy. I think if you talk to those people around Trump, you realise that they basically take the view that Islamic State is America's number one enemy. And if the Russians are prepared to join in that fight, then you should join with them. And I think there is also a calculation made that the Russians are more prepared to take the kind of casualties that will be needed to clean Islamic State out of places like Raqqa than American forces would be.
I think there is a contradiction in the Trump camp, a massive contradiction. They seem, at the one hand, determined to take on Iran and end the nuclear deal and restore the Cold War against Iran at the same time as apparently reconciling with Russia. So, and given that Iran and Russia have formed such a close alliance in the last decade or more, we're going to find I think that both policies at once probably won't work. And the other question is whether the American deep state allows Trump to do these things. I mean, basically, there was a military mutiny against Obama when he struck a deal with Putin 3 months ago to go against Al-Qaeda, and whether that same thing happens again is open to question.
James, moving a little bit closer to home in terms of Trump and Russia, what difference do you think you'll see in terms of our relationship with NATO, in terms of NATO's future security as an organisation over the next year?
Well, I think that Britain's security guarantees to Europe are more important now than they have been since the creation of NATO, because Donald Trump is the most ambiguous American president about NATO since the organisation was first founded. Then you add into this another thing, which is François Fillon, who's likely to be the next president of France, assuming he beats Marine Le Pen in the runoff. He is very friendly with Russia. He thinks that all sanctions on Russia for its involvement, for its annexation of Crimea and its involvement in Ukraine, should be lifted immediately, which makes Britain more important to the security and safety of the Baltic republics and the frontline Eastern European states than it has ever been. And I think that will have quite a profound impact and influence.
If we sent 150 troops to Poland, I think that will really have frightened Mr. Putin. But at least it was 150 more than we sent in 1939.
I mean, this is a question, which is there is a genuine argument here, which is this. If the Americans are going to start pulling back from NATO, the UK needs to consider what it wants to do. And even if you're spending the NATO minimum of 2%, as Peter says, he's not actually going to give you the kind of resources that can act as an effective deterrent. I think we might well be looking back towards heading back towards kind of much more Cold War era levels of defence spending of 4% or so.
I don't actually think that the United States will pull out of NATO, and I don't think either that we can go back on our existing treaty commitments. And I don't think Putin, foolish though some people think they were, but I also don't think Putin is going to start to invade, cross any boundaries, NATO boundaries. And so I feel though that there is a basis for an understanding with Putin. I mean, he sees himself as the protector of Christendom in the Near East. That's the traditional role of the Russian Tsars, and I think he very much sees himself as their inheritor. What has been paradoxical has been that we have turned our back on Christendom in the Middle East. We have been on the side of the militant, formed the strategic alliances with militant jihadists who have determined to cut every throat of every last Christian. So I think that has been a weird thing which Britain has been doing. It's following an alliance with militant jihad, which we've carried on since the Afghan invasion, or not before. And so I think that there is a genuine basis for a reconciliation between the West and Putin.
And finally, if people are wanting not to be blindsided by events in 2017 in the way that a lot of people claim they have been in 2016, what should we look out for, starting with James? What one trend, what one movement should we keep an eye on?
I would watch the rise of hostility to the euro in southern Europe. In the height of the Greek crisis, even as you had German civil servants sitting in Greek government buildings saying what the budgets could be, the Greek people still wanted to stay in the euro by an overwhelming amount. I don't think that is going to be the case in Italy, and I think Italy is the big country to watch this year, because what separates Italy from either France or Holland is it's not just one party in Italy that is against the euro. It is the two leading opposition parties are against the euro, and the third one is increasingly hostile to it. So this actually suggests that there is actually the kind of electoral numbers possibly to put an anti-euro government into office.
Peter.
Very interesting, we haven't talked about Brexit at all in this conversation, which I think will go quite smoothly, by the way. And I think Article 50 will be duly take place and whatever it does, and then we'll have a negotiation, so that'll go very quietly. I think Leicester City will win the European Championship. That Europe is the thing. I agree with James so much, it's the thing to watch.
That was James Forsyth and Peter Oborne. And finally, as a special Christmas treat, I asked each of our contributors what was for them the moment that best summed up 2016. Here's how they responded.
I think it was from the American election, but it wasn't Donald Trump. It was when the Libertarian candidate, Gary Johnson, was asked, what would you do about the situation in Aleppo? And he said, and what is Aleppo? And there was this nervous pause, and the interviewer said, you're kidding, right? And he said, no. And it was just gloriously hilarious, and it sort of summed up for me the complete craziness of the 2016 race. And also, I thought it was sort of rather beautiful in a way. Why should he know what Aleppo is?
I think my moment of the year was it definitely on the morning of the 24th of June. And like everybody else in the country, whether we had been for leave or remain, very nervous, very worried. And I bumped into a person from UKIP, who I won't name, a very nice person, who was sitting outside a pub in Westminster. And I said, well, congratulations, what now? And he said, today we get pissed. And I think it's the only time in my adult life I've almost felt physically violent. My view in general is that this was a year where people should start to build and really work. And this was my personal nadir.
Moments of 2016, there was a moment in the American presidential elections where all the camera crews suddenly rushed round to the Trump Tower because some guy in a sort of superhero outfit had got suction pads on his feet and hands and was climbing up the Trump Tower to try and get to see Donald Trump. And this sort of was my 2016 equivalent of Yeats's rough beast, thou now come slouching towards Bethlehem. Instead of slouching towards Bethlehem, you're sucking your way up the Trump Tower.
The big moment for me was when I decided to write this book. I was absolutely determined not to write a book about the referendum, and I was standing at Theresa May's campaign launch reading an email sent by Michael Gove explaining why Boris Johnson should not be the Prime Minister. And I thought, hey, we've got to write this thing now. And it was like looking at the future standing in front of you and the past, what might have been, on the phone, gently disappearing up in smoke.
So I think the image of the year has got to be Donald Trump and Nigel Farage standing outside that incredibly gaudy lift door in Trump Tower. Because what it sums up is the extent to which the established order had been overturned, and how we now have an American president who doesn't feel himself bound by any of the normal restraints of protocol or diplomatic niceties. And I think it says something else which is important, which is that the president of the United States views himself, the president-elect, I should say, even now he has won, he views himself as a kind of outsider against the kind of global elite and establishment.
For me, actually, it was Leicester City winning the premiership, because it said so much about this incredible year. It's a year which has defied all predictions. It's been utterly amazing. And I think historians are going to look back at it as a bit like 1848, the year of the revolutions, a bit like, I hope not like 1914.
For me, it was the American election night. The polls suggested something like a 0.1% chance of Trump winning. That was Princeton University. And yet we'd prepared a huge Trump wins edition for the magazine. I was rather sad that it would never see the light of day. And I asked Freddie Gray, who's over in the States, to call me if it looked like Trump was going to win. And about an hour and a half after I went to bed, my phone rang. And my wife went, oh, my God. And she said, if your alarm went off, that means Hillary's won. If your phone is wrong, that means Trump has won. And she was right. So he came into the office, and then Lara Prendergast had been out at a party, had come straight from the party into work, and we all sat down transforming that edition. It was the most incredibly exciting, journalistically, 12 hours I think I've spent. As a citizen, it's all rather terrifying, but as a journalist, you can't ask for a better drama.
And that's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can also subscribe to our other podcasts, including our books podcast, where this week they've been debating the legacy of Roald Dahl. And if you enjoy the podcasts, Christmas is the perfect time to try the magazine. We've got a bumper edition in stores now, and why not treat your friends and family to the perfect present? A year's subscription to The Spectator costs just £75 and comes with a bottle of champagne. Thanks for listening, and do join us again in the new year.